I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Here's the name of a new breast cancer drug you'll be hearing more about. It's called exemestane. Researchers are about to embark on a clinical trial testing exemestane on some 4,600 women in the United States and Canada and Spain. Here's the twist. The women who've agreed to join the drug trial don't have breast cancer. They never have had breast cancer. They're healthy. The only thing they have in common is that they're considered to be at high risk of getting breast cancer, either because of family history or age. This hour, we'll talk with the breast cancer researcher, Dr. Paul Goss, and we'll hear from one woman who's not sure that giving drugs to healthy people is the best way to attack breast cancer. We'd also like to know what you think. Would you take part in a trial like this one? Do you think there's anything wrong with healthy people taking drugs simply because they are at risk of developing a disease? Or is this one way, one attempt to reduce the number of the 40,000 women a year who die of breast cancer in this country? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're starting today with Dr. Paul Goss. He joins me in the studio. He is director of breast cancer research at Mass General Hospital in Boston and a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. It's nice to have you here. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
And I gather you've been working with this type of drug, they're called aromatase inhibitors, for quite some period of time.
That's right. I started my research in this area in 1980, so 25 years of research. I did a PhD thesis at the Institute of Cancer Research in London starting in 1980 on the topic of aromatase inhibitors in the treatment and prevention of breast cancer.
So where are the aromatase inhibitors now in the treatment of breast cancer? Are they used fairly frequently for people who have had breast cancer?
Yes, they've become the most commonly used drug in breast cancer. In fact, probably the single most commonly used cancer drug, period. The application of the drug is really two-thirds of all women with breast cancer have so-called hormone-dependent breast cancer, and we know that estrogen is the band leader or the orchestra conductor of the disease. It probably initiates and promotes the disease. And using aromatase inhibitors has become widely applied to women with early-stage breast cancer. It was first used in advanced breast cancer, and now it's being used in early-stage disease as a prevention of recurrence.
So if the drugs, the aromatase inhibitors, have been around for as long as you say, why are we only just now beginning a trial testing the drug on women who are at high risk?
The inhibitors have followed a classic course of drug development in cancer medicine, which is most drugs are tested in the patients with the most advanced and serious disease first, and the inhibitors gained a footing in that setting in the early 90s to mid-90s. That took about 5 to 10 years to establish. After that, they were then moved into early-stage disease, and in the past decade, over 20,000 women have been in clinical trials with aromatase inhibitors lasting for 5 years.
These are all women who have had breast cancer.
These are all women who are postmenopausal who've had early stage breast cancer, but they are perfectly healthy otherwise. These are women who've been treated with curative intent and have no recurrence yet. And the thing that was so exciting about those trials is that we discovered that in the opposite breast to the cancer, we found approximately 60 to 80% reduction in the appearance of new cancer. In other words, a preventative effect. So very strong data coming from three different drugs in this family, all showing the same thing, a profound reduction, much more so than tamoxifen, which, as you know, has been used in prevention.
These are the two, right? The aromatase inhibitors and tamoxifen.
Right.
That's your choice if you're a doctor or if you're a woman dealing with breast cancer.
I think the point is that we've come to understand the key role of estrogen and that anti-estrogen therapy is likely to be a profoundly important way to prevent breast cancer. And tamoxifen is one way to do that, but it has, as you mentioned earlier, it has serious side effects. And the aromatase inhibitors seem to be much safer and much more effective. And so breast cancer doctors really are the envy of other oncologists with other common solid tumor cancers like colon cancer, prostate cancer, and other lung cancer and other cancers don't have the excitement of a pill on the horizon, which looks like it may reduce the risk of this disease by 60 to 80%.
I have to ask you a question that I know is going to be in the mind of some people, because whenever we're talking about major treatments of disease and new drugs, people go, oh, yeah, well, this is a pharmaceutical company, and they've got a doctor who's out selling a prevention pill, and they're going to make billions of dollars. What's your link with pharmaceutical companies in doing this?
None of us are completely independent of sponsorship from pharmaceutical industry when we do these types of trials, mainly because of the enormous cost of conducting these trials. These trials are usually in the tens of millions of dollars to conduct. The U.S. NCI, the Canadian NCIC...
These are the National Cancer Institutes.
Yeah. They're involved in sponsoring this type of research, and indeed this trial was not a pharmaceutical company idea. This is an idea that I had. I work with all the aromatase inhibitors. I've worked in the laboratory for 25 years. I've worked in the clinic with all of them. The idea came directly from work that I've been doing for the past 20 years. I approached the National... I'm a member of the National Cancer Institute of Canada. As you know, I've just relocated to the United States. Mm-hmm. And I approached them with the design of this trial, and it was really a build-on. And I chose this particular inhibitor of a family of three because it has some really important additional effects that we think make it superior for use in healthy women.
I do want to ask you about the numbers, though, because when you look at the data that you have so far on the trials... where this drug has been tested. And you say in the opposite breast, it's showing a 60 to 80% reduction in the risk of breast cancer. Do you extrapolate that straight across to, say, a woman who's just been through menopause and may never have had breast cancer but may be a part of this drug trial? Do you think that you could say to her that it offers a 60 to 80% chance of preventing breast cancer?
All the evidence is that breast cancer is a continuum over many decades. It starts with healthy ductal cells in the breast, and it moves through hyperplasia, atypical hyperplasia, carcinoma in situ, so-called stage zero carcinoma, and then invasive cancer, and then, unfortunately, in a proportion of women, metastatic cancer. So we see it as a continuum. And what we've learned from previous experience is that if we barricade this disease, if we obstruct estrogen in the pathway of this disease's development, the earlier you barricade it, the bigger the effect. So, in fact, we anticipate in prevention a bigger effect than in prevention in early stage patients. So if anything, it's like a golf ball being driven off a tee, and the closer you are to the disease's inception, the greater the impact downstream on reduction. So we anticipate at least a 60% reduction in cancer risk, in the events of cancer on this trial.
And you were saying earlier that the side effects of exemestane, have I said that right?
Exemestane.
Right. I'm going to get it wrong. Are less troublesome than the side effects of tamoxifen. What do you know now about the side effects of exemestane?
Yeah, there are really two issues that I think we're going to discuss. This is one. The two issues are, how do we expose the least number of women possible to a medication that would prevent a disease? And secondly, how do we do it safely? Mm-hmm. And the first thing to ensure that the listeners understand is that we are extremely cognizant of women's health in general. So this trial is a breast cancer prevention trial, as its arrow head, but it's really a women's health trial. We are looking at the credit and debit balance columns. We are looking, in other words, at total good versus total harm, if there's harm. Now, we have over 20,000 women. Unlike predecessors, even tamoxifen, we have over 20,000 women treated up to 5 years. Mm. We know a lot about the side effects of this class of drugs, and we know a lot about this particular drug. We have all kinds of checks and balances. There are women, tens of thousands of women, getting this therapy for greater than 5 years right as we speak. And as this trial evolves, we will have data fed back to us from those trials.
I still need you to give me that kind of like television advertisement checklist of things that you know you have to watch for.
Right. So the way that the drug works is it lowers estrogen. And estrogen is key to women's health generally. So it could be important in cognitive function, bone metabolism, cardiovascular risk, urogenital function, psychosexual function, and many other functions. So what... But it also may have benefits beyond breast cancer prevention, by the way, in addition. So what we are doing is, within the context of these five women, we are very carefully studying subgroups of the women.
Right.
We are looking at all those endpoints. We have specific scientific studies looking at cognitive function, at exercise, at the role of diet. We're looking at quality of life and bone metabolism, lipid metabolism, etc. So really, this trial is a vehicle to understand women's health in the context of breast cancer risk. It is not just a breast cancer prevention trial.
Let me, if I can, bring Barbara Brenner in on the program. She's Executive Director of Breast Cancer Action. It's a San Francisco-based advocacy group, and Barbara is also herself a breast cancer survivor. She's joining us from the studios of KQED. Hi, Barbara. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Dick.
You've had a chance to listen along. I'm curious to know, what is it that concerns you about what you've heard of this trial?
Well, Breast Cancer Action has been concerned for a number of years, as we've called for over 15 years, for real prevention of breast cancer, figuring out what is causing this disease in the first place,
right?
Eradicating those causes. We're very concerned that this is a trial that will lead ultimately, as all of the previous trials like this have led, to disease substitution instead of disease
prevention. What's disease substitution?
What we mean is you take a very powerful drug. I think Dr. Goss would agree, and I have great respect for his work and all of that he's done on these issues that concern so many of us. But he understands that these are very powerful drugs, and it's almost impossible to even imagine a very powerful drug that will reduce your risk of breast cancer, and prevention is not the word we should use here. We should use risk reduction as the phrase, that will prevent your reduce your risk of breast cancer, but not give you some other disease. For example, in the instance of aromatase inhibitors, there's a great concern that these drugs increase your risk of osteoporosis because of the estrogen effects that they have. That's just one example. We don't actually have, though I understand that Dr. Goss is pointing to 20,000 women who've taken this drug for more than 5 years. That's a lot of women over a relatively short time. That's not any number of women over a very long time. And we know from our experience with tamoxifen, for example, that a lot of people develop side effects that the medical community didn't even recognize for years until years later.
Barbara, I'm going to stop you right there. We have to take a short break. We're going to come back. We'll continue the conversation. At that point, listeners, we'd like to hear from you. We're at 1-800-423-8255. There are risks with any new drug, but there are also great promises for any new drug. Based on what you're hearing, would you join a drug trial like this? Is this one of the ways of beating breast cancer? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Dr. Paul Goss is here with me in the studio. He is director of breast cancer research at Mass General Hospital in Boston and a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, and just beginning a new trial which will involve some 4,600 women taking an aromatase inhibitor called exemestane, which he's hoping will significantly reduce their risk of getting breast cancer. Barbara Brenner is with us. She's executive director of Breast Cancer Action. It's a San Francisco-based advocacy group. Okay, there's a lot on the table here, and we've a number of callers who want to join us, but let's see if we can move through a couple of the issues here. First to Paul on this question of the effect of the aromatase inhibitors on bone density. It's something that Barbara knows.
I'm very grateful that Barbara is on the line, and I think it's really important to have checks and balances like this for women entering trials. I think none of us want to see pharmaceutical companies leading women unwittingly into dangerous clinical trials. We have chosen exemestane in this family of aromatase inhibitor for specific reasons. We've been studying its effect on bone for about half a decade to a decade. And what we believe is that this compound, unlike the other inhibitors, it reduces estrogen, which increases bone resorption, but it has a mild male hormone, a kind of androgenic effect on the bone, which we've demonstrated well in...
Which does what?
Which strengthens the bone's cortex and strengthens its tensile strength. We believe that this will counteract any risk of osteoporotic fracture, any clinical risk of weakening of the bone. So we are studying this very carefully. We've looked at this with other inhibitors, and we're looking at it in the context of this trial. Also, I want to point out that there are two really interesting things. When you give a therapy like this to prevent breast cancer, it appears to operate during the 5 years. And then when you stop the therapy, it hangs over for decades afterwards and reduces risk thereafter. But the side effects are partially or largely reversed. So 5 years seems like a long time, but in a menopausal woman's life, or in the complete reproductive years of a woman's life, it's a very short time. Actually, 5 years to obstruct a cancer evolution for 5 years is actually a small, short period in a journey, say from Boston to Florida, you drive slowly for 2 hours. That's more or less what you're doing to the breast like this.
Let's go back to Barbara Brenner here. I'm wondering, Barbara, if there's a line here for you. When you listen to Paul describing the test, is there a point where you would say, hey, the risk may be I'm getting my tongue tied up. Is there a point where the risks on one side balance the others?
There may ultimately be a point, I think, where the risk may balance the benefits. But again, I think one of the things Dr. Goss was saying is that they have some studies. I suspect they're animal studies on bone reabsorption. They're not human studies, is my guess.
Well, no, we have a human study as well, actually.
Well, a single study, as you know, doctor, doesn't get us very far home.
But what do you do, though? I mean, at some point, do you need to have people who take the chance, Barbara? I'm sorry, I don't mean to be interrupting you, but at some point, do you need to say to women, do you want to be a part of this? Do you think this is worthwhile?
And I think the answer to that is if they can get fully informed consent, and if they understand that what we're talking about here is treating healthy women. Mm-hmm. You mentioned at the top of the show that one of the things that puts you at high risk is age. If you're over 60, you're gonna meet the risk criteria for this drug.
Higher risk of getting breast cancer, just
higher
to be
risk
clear.
Of getting breast cancer. Women routinely overestimate their risk of getting breast cancer. It's well documented. So there are going to be a lot of people who think they're at high risk of breast cancer, maybe because their mother had postmenopausal disease, who will want to be in this trial. So the great challenge is what is truly informed consent? And without long-term side effect data, I don't know how we can do that. I want to stress that there's a very different – the risk-benefit analysis is absolutely the same. What risk you're exposed to if you've had breast cancer are the same as the risk you'd be exposed to as a healthy woman. But the balance, how you evaluate that and how we as a society should look at that should be very different when we're talking about exposing healthy people to very powerful drugs, the long-term side effects of which are unknown.
1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, let's hear what your thoughts are on this. To Sherburn, Massachusetts, Karen's on the line. Hi, Karen.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I am really upset about this path we're going down, and I would just like to throw out the discussion that needs to happen about the economics of both cancer research and the drugs and the prevention aspect. We seem there's lots of funding available to find a pharmaceutical that will treat, and in this case, market a drug to women who don't even have the disease yet. And that's, there's a lot of money to be made in cancer, both in funding and in potential drugs. And yet, when we know that we have carcinogenic compounds in our environment through pesticides, we have estrogen-mimicking chemicals in all kinds of products that we virtually swim in,
mm-hmm.
It doesn't get front-page news. We know we have this information.
But Karen, is it either or? Do you say, look, let's put all our money into taking the estrogen copying chemicals out of the makeup that women wear, and take that money away from cancer research such as the type that Dr. Goss is doing?
We haven't even attempted to be preventative. We don't even get there because chemical companies and all kinds of lobbyists will go to the government and throw up their hands and say, oh my gosh, look what will happen to our company if we take this off the market, and we get silenced. I just think there are far more people that would benefit, particularly our children and our grandchildren, if we start cleaning up the toxic soup we're swimming in. We wouldn't be looking at such increasing cancer rates. And
Let's hear from Paul Goss on this.
I think the point being made is an excellent one, and I think it's very important for me to emphasize that I've looked after over 6,000 breast cancer patients in my career, and I have a deep interest in preventing this disease, and I fully agree with the caller about understanding the cause of this. It is absolutely wrong to imagine that the only type of research and prevention that's going on right now is pill forms of research. I am fascinated by the gain in weight of female infants in the first year of life. I am fascinated by the risk of the number of centimeters grown between the age of 8 and 14 in the course of breast cancer. I'm fascinated by the entire path of breast cancer, and I am researching, and we are researching aggressively in those areas. I'm just publishing a paper on the role of eating flaxseed in the diet as a way of preventing breast cancer. We just have an exciting paper that's about to be published on this. I've been researching in many areas. The point is this. Over the course of 50 to 60 years, lifestyle factors, partly within our control or possibly outside of our control, as the caller suggests, conspire together to put women in the Western world at a substantially elevated risk of breast cancer. And being a doctor, I'm looking for a quick fix for those women who have past that period of time, cannot undo the past. Of course, the ultimate goal here is not to have a pill for women to prevent breast cancer. The ultimate goal is to understand this disease and to prevent it in childhood, teenagehood, and young adulthood, which is where we think the real root cause lies. But if you're a doctor facing this dilemma on a daily basis, women, the public, are asking us. My patients have asked me for 25 years, doctor, do something for us and prevent breast cancer now, please.
Barbara Brenner, what do you think about this?
Well, I really appreciate Karen's question. It's a lot of the work that Breast Cancer Action does, looking at these questions of environmental links. And the economics is absolutely critical. I noticed that Dr. Goss did not actually tell us how much money he gets from Pfizer, the sponsor of this campaign, this study, though I understand, as we all do, how difficult it is to do research without pharmaceutical company money. I run an organization that has absolutely said no to pharmaceutical funding. And we've said no not because the money is bad, but because people really look to us for what we believe is instead of what we're told to say. So I really think it's important to think about it is not an either or question, but we do have limited resources in this sense.
I'm getting a little bit confused here, Barbara. When you say that we don't know how much money Pfizer's putting into this, are you saying that the study is tainted because it takes that money? And we should set that aside?
That actually wasn't the question. I'm sure we could find out how much Pfizer's putting into this study. But you actually asked Dr. Goss how much support he gets from the pharmaceutical industry. And his answer was general and accurate, that everybody who's doing these kinds of studies gets support from the pharmaceutical industry. So the pharmaceutical industry has bottom line interest in these kinds of trials for very good reason. When the first, you know, some of us have memory here. And in 1998, when tamoxifen was first announced as reducing the risk of breast cancer by these very large percentages, and we need to come back to this percentage conversation because it's important. When tamoxifen was first announced as reducing the risk, they talked about the millions of women who were going to benefit from these drugs. Now, they have not rushed to take them for very good reasons. Mm-hmm. But we need to understand that there is always money as the bottom line of these kind of trials. And to the extent that we have limited resources to devote, we really should be spending the kinds of resources we spend on these pills for prevention trials. This is not the first, nor will it be the last, I'm afraid.
Our telephone number, let me just stop you here and make sure that our listeners know how to get in touch with us. We're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking about a new study of a drug which could significantly reduce the risk of breast cancer. Should the money go only in that direction? What's the history there? Paul Goss, you are up against a history which does not favor you. You look at the way that women were told that hormone replacement therapy was a great thing for them, and the bottom fell out of that. Tamoxifen has serious side effects, which women are learning about. And I guess there's suspicion, is there not, about anything that comes on that's new?
Yes, I think that all the points being made are accurate. And again, as I say, I think checks and balances are important. The difference here is that one of the things the listeners should understand is that the sophistication of research techniques has advanced tremendously, tremendously in the past decade. And we are not repeating the hormone replacement therapy dilemma that faced women, which was that it did do some good, but it did more harm. And, mm-hmm. and disease substitution, as Ms. Brenner correctly points out, is precisely what women want to avoid. We are doing a very carefully controlled study in a limited number of people to avoid precisely that. It's important to recognize that women widely understand the preventative effects of this class of drugs already and already are asking for this widely, and we would not want to drift into a repeat of the hormone replacement therapy era. I just want to also emphasize, in case any listener misunderstands this, I personally receive no support from the pharmaceutical industry whatsoever. Of course, the trial is being somewhat sponsored by Pfizer, who makes this particular drug. We approached Pfizer, as I pointed out. The head office of this is an independent academic institution affiliated with Queen's University in Canada.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Let's bring Dr. Michael Groden in. He is a psychiatrist and director of medical ethics at Boston University. He's been listening along, and he's been with us before. Michael, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
You know both sides of this, and I bet you hear these kinds of questions from your patients. Do I get involved in a trial like this or don't? How do you advise them?
Well, first of all, I spent 12 years as the chairman of the Human Studies Committee for the Department of Health and Hospitals for the City of Boston, which means the ethics committee that reviews research. And what I would say is that this is a tough one, obviously. But I think what's real important is to realize the difference between research and treatment. that this is not treatment, this is not even prevention or risk reduction, this is a research study, and research study is done to gain generalizable knowledge. Research is not done to benefit the individual patient, it's done to gain information, as is evidenced by the fact that this is a placebo arm in this study where people don't get any active ingredient. They may be lucky they got the placebo arm. So the goal here is to gain some knowledge. And therefore, research is always suspect. And of course, the difficulty in research is that you're balancing risks, which are unknown, at least in this compound, I guess, over long term, versus benefits that are accruing to society. And then you have the particular problem of that you're dealing with not a disease, but risk against risk. But one of the things I think, and of course, prevention, you know, aspirin, anti-cholesterol drugs, hypertensive drugs are given to people who are not had a problem yet and are being done to prevent a problem. But I think one of the things that's real important that I would ask physician to comment on is we want to be careful in terms of explaining to patients, research subjects in this case, what we mean by risk. And I think it's very important to distinguish what we call relative risk from absolute risk. So if in fact...
I don't understand the difference between those two terms.
So let me give you an example. If in fact the risk of 1,000 women, if only 5 were going to get cancer, breast cancer of the 1,000, and this compound reduced the risk from 5 down to 1, we would say there was an 80% reduction in risk, but still 955 were never going to get cancer at all. Okay, so you can talk about a percent drop in risk. But if the risk itself is very tiny, then the question is that's a very different question for an individual person to make a decision about taking a drug which may have potential serious harm for benefit, which, again, 955 times out of 1,000 were not going to happen anyway. So I think the real issue is trying to sort out some very difficult concepts about probabilities. But again, the most important thing to remember is this is a research study, and therefore, assuming it's okay to proceed, you have to give the woman the absolute amount of information, and then voluntary, informed understanding, consent is very, very important.
Relative risk versus what was the absolute risk?
Yeah, it's an excellent point, and I really thank the doctor very much. You know, it's like my house is 10 times more likely to be struck by lightning than yours. It's 10 in a million versus 1 in a million. Both are unlikely, so absolutely true. And the number of cancers here is measured in hundreds versus the number of women exposed, which is thousands. So what we're talking about is the numbers needed to treat, and this has been a highly controversial point. If you just give me a second. One strategy of identifying women who need a prevention is to look for a marker that indicates the risk. So I can study populations, I can do ductal aspiration and study the cells which we're doing from the nipple, a nipple aspirate, and look for abnormal cells and say these are the women that really need this, and go on and on down that scientific path, trying to refine the women in the population that should get prevention so that you don't expose 1,000 women to help 50 women or 20 women, you expose fewer. Now, We believe that you need to pursue both strategies simultaneously. So we are looking for so-called intermediate surrogate markers of risk where we can refine risk. But no vehicle gives you the power to do that better than a phase 3 trial like this where cancer is the end point of the trial. Our trial, we are taking a blood sample from all consenting participants where we will do whole genome analysis. We are going to be able at the end of this trial to look at breast density, plasma hormone levels, bone density, proteomic levels, proteomic studies in the plasma, and genetic information. And we will be able at the end of this trial to say three things, I believe. One, we prevented breast cancer in those who were destined to get it, albeit of not that many women, but we more than halved the risk. Two, we did it safely, and the mild side effects that would have occurred, we were able to counteract. Three, we now are in a position to know who did get cancer, who can we sort out at the conclusion of this trial, and we can refine down the numbers needed. We can also look at who got the side effects and who got the therapy and benefited, who got the therapy and didn't benefit. All that information will yield a very, very refined way of preventing this disease in the future and exactly address the points that both of the other speakers are raising.
Okay, we have to take a break. We will be back. We'll talk more about this. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Dr. Grodin, thank you so much for your time. Nice to have you for a moment on the program.
Very good. Thank you.
Michael Grodin is a psychiatrist and director of medical ethics at Boston University. 1-800-423-TALK. Connection listeners, your thoughts or ideas on giving drugs to healthy people to learn more about the effects of the drug and whether or not you would take part in a trial like this. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. You're listening to The Connection. My name is Dick Gordon. This hour, we're talking about a new clinical trial testing one of the aromatase inhibitors, exemestane, which could significantly reduce the risk of breast cancer. And yet it could also bring some side effects, some of which may not be known just yet. So what do you think about getting involved in a trial like that, this kind of test? 1-800-423-8255. We're going to start in Raleigh, North Carolina. Jenna is with us. Hi, Jenna.
Hi.
What do you think?
Well, I'm sitting here in the waiting room of my radiologist's office at Duke. I was listening to the show on the way here, and it's a very personal issue to me, having been diagnosed last October. My comments to the woman who is, I'm sorry, I don't remember her name. I have chemo brain still. the woman who is...
with us from San Francisco is Barbara.
Yeah. Cancer Coalition,
yeah.
Is that, you know, no magic fairy is going to drop these drugs in our lap. So at some point, we do take risks, and I think those risks should be assessed by the participants. And my comments to the researcher are, I do think we need more transparency in this process, and I think the FDA needs to be on the side of the participant and less on the side of the drug companies. All that said, I do think that I would join this. I would join the study.
Would you, Jenna? Would you do it for yourself? Would you do it if you knew that it might have benefits for your daughters or you know, younger people? How do you look at getting involved in something like this?
I think you look at all of those things, and you know, I think all of them are important. I would do it for myself because, believe me, what I've gone through is not fun. I mean, I just can't even imagine, you know, women in their 70s who go through chemo. It was excruciating.
Can I ask you to stay on the line, because you put a question to each one of my guests, and I'd like to hear them both respond. First to Barbara in San Francisco.
Jenna, it's nice to meet you, and I'm very sorry that you're in a member of what I refer to as the dreaded sisterhood. I have been where you are, so, and I know the chemo brain story, but you're sounding awfully articulate to me. I agree with you that there are no magic fairies, nor are there any magic bullets, tragically, in all of this. And I appreciate what you say about letting the participants assess the side effects. But the question here is, for healthy women, as I see it, for healthy women, to some degree going into these trials, we have to be able to give them information about the side effects, because they're entitled to give informed consent, just as you were entitled to do so when you decided to undergo chemotherapy. So it's a real difficult question. Yes, participants ought to be able to evaluate how they feel on these drugs and report back to their doctors how they are on these drugs. But these are drugs for which we really have relatively short-term use in any context. So I think we ought to be a little more cautious.
Well, I agree with that, but I also say to you, you know, some people don't have long-term options. You know, they tell me that my breast cancer, even though it was 1 centimeter, I've had for 10 years.
Oh, I do. I know this story. All of us who have had even small tumors know how long have heard this, hopefully. But let me point out to you that while you may ultimately get an aromatase inhibitor, I know nothing about the pathology of your cancer or what your doctors are recommending, you wouldn't even be eligible for this trial because you've had breast cancer already. And again, we're talking about healthy people here.
All right, let's if we can, just take the other part of what Jenna raised, and that was more transparency in the studies. Does she have a point, Paul?
Of course, transparency is essential in research, and it speaks to the fundamental ethics of conducting research. In this trial, as in all the trials that I've been involved in, a true, absolute, not relative, risk information is given to women. The consent form is very detailed. I invite anybody to look at it. It's extremely detailed. It's extremely informative. The process of consent is more than a form. It's a verbal process in front of a doctor. So there's great care taken. To my knowledge and my personal experience, the FDA is extremely rigorous in protecting the public's safety. So I actually personally would take issue with the assumption that the FDA works in favor of the pharmaceutical industry. We are hauled over the coals, but make no mistake, by the FDA. These trials don't appear overnight, as everybody knows. This takes years and years and years to get to the table. And we go through an extraordinarily rigorous process of declaration. Our fundamental interest is to protect the women who participate in this trial. We're not protecting the public in general. We're protecting women in this research study. Half of 4,600 women, 2,300 women, will be exposed to this drug.
Mm-hmm.
That's a large number of women, but they are fully informed of the risks and the potential benefits. And I believe we do know a lot about the side effects, and I believe we will and do inform them very carefully about the risk.
Jenna, anything that you want to add? Oh, she's not there. I want to thank you, Jenna, for your call, and we wish you all the very best. 1-800-423-8255. Next to Augusta, Georgia, Julie's on the line. Hi, Julie.
Yes, hello. I had breast cancer 6 years ago. I had no family risk, and I had a very healthy diet, exercise. I had no risk. However, I had taken hormone replacement therapy, and I, after reflecting for over the past 6 years, I see so much money going into fixing a problem after we get cancer. I see so little going into preventing the causes. I think mine was probably hormone replacement, which was okayed by the FDA. And I have troubles when Barbara Brenner is cut off in some of the statements that she was trying to make about the link between the pharmaceutical companies and the research that's going on. We have to look at causes of the cancer before we get it and spending lots of money to fix it. And yes, you can fix it. You can try to prevent it with these medicines like aromatase inhibitors, which don't have long-term studies on them. And we just need a longer look at this and more look at what's in the environment.
How are you doing now, Julie?
I'm doing fine.
Well, good.
Thanks. The Relay for Life, I almost am ready to go to all the Relays for Life and say, why are you spending so much money? Why are you, these little towns are being honored for raising all this money for cancer. Let's raise money to look at the causes and the water supply and the air we breathe, the food we eat. We're spending so little money on that.
I do want to say that at the end of our program, Julie, for people who want to go to our website at theconnection.org, and I say at the end because we collect these through the program, we'll have links to Breast Cancer Action. I mean, this is Barbara's group. It's done some tremendous work in dealing with things like parabens and phthalates in makeup and other stuff like that. I don't want to leave you with the impression that we're trying to cut that part of the conversation off, but we're here to talk in large part about the trial and the usefulness of these kinds of trials. But Barbara, you'll add your voice to Julie in this, no doubt.
Oh, absolutely. This is big business. Breast Cancer Action has been asked and is frequently asked because we're a watchdog organization. And there are people all over country who call us and say, so how much money is being spent in breast cancer research? And I wish I could answer the question. This is a very big industry. And a lot of good work is being done. There is no doubt about it. But we really need to focus more of our attention on what's the underlying causes of the disease,
right,
and less of our attention on a pills approach.
1-800-423-8255 to Brighton, Massachusetts. Barbara's with us. Hi, Barbara.
Hello. I am a woman over 60, postmenopausal, and I was part of the Women's Health Initiative study, which I entered over 8 years ago, which was the study which determined that hormone replacement therapy had
greater risks and
greater
benefits
risk than a benefit. And I did so because I believe in it. I mean, I'd call it altruism if you want, but I think there were something like 160,000 women involved at many sites all over the country in various parts of this study. And none of us did it for ourselves. We all did it for the next generation. The informed consent was very, very careful. The monitoring was exceedingly careful. In the minute there was shown to be an increased risk of stroke and heart disease, mm-hmm. and that was, as Dr. Groden was saying before, it was an increased relative risk, but the total risk was still extremely small. They told us all to stop our medications, and then we found out whether we were on the active drug or not. But I think it's, if the woman from San Francisco is saying, you know, well, you've got animal studies and you've only got one human study. I mean, this is how you get more human studies, but with people like myself volunteering to do this.
And you're saying that the risk is worth it, not for you, but as part, as a contribution to research?
Sure, for my three daughters-in-law and for, you know, the generations that will come after us.
I would imagine, Paul, you'd sort of agree with what Barbara's saying here, that this is part of why you're finding women who are willing to do this?
Yes, I think the caller, I really appreciate the fact that she made the point she did. And just to say that many of the prestigious researchers involved in our study were the same researchers that were participants in the Women's Health Initiative study. And as mentioned, 160,000 women were taken after 3 decades of a random use of that medication. 160,000 women contributed to knocking down the fallacy around it. However, much has been learnt about breast cancer from that. Just 2 points. One is that the science in this study will help. I said that earlier, but I want to reemphasize. We are studying this study is not a study about pills. The pill is a mirror image of the pathogenesis of the disease, how the disease evolves. We learn an awful lot about this disease by studying who gets it in the context of this. We are going to study the genetic makeup, the lifestyle habits, the diet, the body mass index, the bone density, all kinds of issues, the past medication exposures of participants in this trial.
If in your trial, though, you find that there are unexpected side effects, would it be the kind of trial that you just sort of tear down 3 years into it and say, this is, whoa.
Oh, absolutely. You know, we have just a series of check and balances. First of all, we are being fed data from other trials around the world on this class of drugs.
Right.
We have trials ourselves that we're conducting in breast cancer patients, which we're feeding back. And we have, and I hope Ms. Brenner doesn't take issue with this, we have a totally independent data safety monitoring committee with no link or agenda with the pharmaceutical industry, if anybody's suspicious. And they monitor this very carefully, and they look specifically. Their mandate is just to protect the participants for safety purposes. So just as happened in the WHI study, when the relative risk of a side effect, and if you're going to talk about the relative risk being small for the effect, mm-hmm. it's also true for the side effect, we would pull the trigger immediately on the study in the interest of safety.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Barbara, I want to ask you a question that I asked you earlier in the program, that if you don't do this kind of work, if you don't have people who are volunteering for this, how do you ever get the data that you're saying is lacking right now?
Well, the data that's lacking right now is not about whether or not a pill will help reduce the risk of breast cancer. I want to come back to this question of prevention. As Dr. Goss has pointed out, some people, it's very likely that some people in this trial, as the trial goes forward, who are getting the treatment side, who aren't getting placebo, will still develop breast cancer. And then they're going to try to figure out why. What was it about those people that led to that? That means that this drug, in the way that the public understands the word prevention, doesn't prevent the disease. It reduces the risk. And the difference between prevention and risk reduction is a very real thing to the general public. And we need to really watch our words when we talk about these kinds
of
drugs.
Okay, but my question doesn't really change. You keep talking about missing data, and I don't know how you get there. Skip us the you know,
sure.
Is it prevention or is it risk reduction? If you don't have women, like a couple of them who have called us on the program, who say, we need to do this, then how do you get there?
Well, you do that by not doing these trials before you have long-term follow-up data on people who have been in treatment. You cannot, you know, when the tamoxifen trial started, back in the early 1990s, we already had 25 years of data treating patients with this disease. We actually knew something about the side effects profile that we do not know about aromatase inhibitors, because they've only really been in the treatment context since, as Dr. Goss pointed out, the late 90s. They've only been used in women who are relatively healthy, which is to say they've had breast cancer, their breast cancer has been treated, they don't have any current disease, and they're given an aromatase inhibitor to reduce their risk of a recurrence. That's only been true since 2002. It's not exactly the case that we have long-term side effect data. And when we're talking about exposing healthy people to very powerful drugs, I think we owe that to the general public.
Paul Goss, do you want to say anything here, or am I going to another call?
I think that one of the misconceptions in this entire field, and I tried to allude to this earlier, is that there are a group of perfectly healthy people in the population, and then there are a small number of women who get breast cancer. For every woman who gets breast cancer, there are at least 10 women walking around in the street with the precursor of breast cancer, and there are another 10 times
women who are at risk of
cancer. Right. This is a huge group of the. All of us would get cancer if we lived long enough. All of us die with many of our organs on the way to getting cancer. Breast cancer is a continuum. The day of diagnosis is a human-made day. It's not something the disease plans. And we are not dividing this into perfectly healthy women are getting exposed versus those victims who've got cancer. This is moving a treatment into an earlier stage of the same disease. And I don't think Barbara Brenner or anybody else knows whether we're preventing or risk reducing.
Let's, if we can, squeak in one more call. Nancy's on the line from Boston. And we're right at the end of the program. Nancy, what's the one thing you want to leave us with?
I want to say that as a cancer survivor with inflammatory carcinoma that was estrogen negative, which is important, I would do this trial, and I think it's because without what has been done before, I wouldn't be living today. And I would do this for my daughter and for all the young women. And I would put my life a bit at risk to know that other people younger would have the opportunity to have some of the research done for treatment options that I've been able to benefit from.
Nancy, thanks for your call.
You're welcome.
And just a word for our listeners. Give us a few minutes to get our website organized, but we need to leave you with 1-800 numbers and links to the National Cancer Institute, to Breast Cancer Action, a chance for you to follow up on a lot of what we've talked about on the program here. Paul Goss, it was great to have you here. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it very much.
Dr. Goss is Director of Breast Cancer Research at Mass General Hospital in Boston. Barbara Brenner, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
Barbara is Executive Director of Breast Cancer Action. Earlier in the program, a couple of words with Dr. Michael Groden, who's Director of the Bioethics Program at Boston University. Tara Murphy's our Senior Producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.